Bacht Mina had already packed up the pup tent and was now rooting around the flatbed. They'd found all the weapons, except the boot knife and her Glock still snugged in its paddle holster at her waist beneath the sheepskin jacket she'd taken from the ranger station. She prayed that no one thought to make her unbutton the jacket. Most of their ammo was in a separate soft pack they'd taken from the gun safe, and she watched now as the younger old guy dug out the ammo pack. "Found it!" The guy had a face that looked as if someone had taken an iron to it when he was a baby. "Got your 45 cal? Got your 9 mils? Got your 22s for the buck mark?" "What about for the rifle and shotgun?" the woman called over her shoulder. "It's all here." Iron Face zipped up the soft pack. "I get the Winchester. I'm sick of this pissant 22. Like to pitch the thing." "We're not pitching anything," the older guy rumbled. He was bald, round, and florid, his jowls covered with thick gray stubble and a roadmap of angry capillaries. "Never can tell when something's going to come in handy. We take it all, what we carried in and what they got."
"Then you're killing us," Tom said. He cinched up the tent's carry bag. "You take everything, our food, our weapons, the truck, and you're as good as shooting us right here and now."
"You want, we can do that," Iron Face said. "Better off without your kind around anyway." Tom ignored him.
"Please, leave us a gun or the bow and one of our packs," he said to the bald guy. "Man, you think I'm going to shoot out the tires with an arrow? You're taking everything else. At least give us a fighting chance."
Alex saw the indecision in the older guy's face. Iron Face must have sensed this as well, because he said, "Hey, shut the fuck up. Don't listen to him, Brett."
"Please," Tom said.
"I said for you to shut up."
"I'm sorry, but I can't help you," Brett said. "I would if I could, but I can't.
There are three of us, and we got a long way to go to get us down south. I heard they got an army refugee camp there. If you're smart, that's where you'll head, too."
"With what? You're taking everything," said Tom.
"You hoof it, then, same as we have," Iron Face said. "Plenty of farms, plenty of dead people, thanks to you and your kind."
Ellie's cheeks were flushed.
"We didn't do anything. My grandpa died. You're just bullies with guns."
Alex saw the look of shame cross Brett's face, which Tom must also have seen, because he said,
"Brett, that little girl's dad was a soldier, KIA in Iraq. He served his country, and you're gonna kill his kid?"
"Brett," the woman warned.
"You can't leave her here, Brett," Tom said. "You're not that kind of man."
Brett's face wavered. "We could take her. Might be a good thing. Didn't those guys say the army gotta let you in if you got a kid who hasn't changed?" "And there's rule," said Iron Face. "Remember, we heard they're taking people in, whether you got kids or not. Kids is better, though."
"What?"
Ellie cried.
"No," said Tom, inching a step closer.
"You know that's not right, Brett. You want the truck? Take it. But leave us some supplies. Other than the truck, we'll be no better or worse off than you are right now. Everyone will run out sooner or later anyway."
Brett shook his head. "That's not what I heard. I heard the government set up these camps. They're bringing in supplies, like they done in New Orleans."
"How? Brett, you've heard stuff, but so have we. There's no government. The East Coast is gone, man. Nothing works."
"Your truck runs."
"Because it's very old. I know the military might have hardened some of its equipment against this kind of attack, but that's all untested. And if you want the honest truth, I don't think it'll stand up. Brett, things are not going back to normal anytime soon."
"Don't tell me what I already know." Brett's face darkened. "When that thing hit, Harlan's wife dropped dead. A day later, I lost my Jenny to one of your kind."
"I'm sorry for your loss," Tom said, "but we haven't changed."
"Not yet, you haven't. Soon as you do, all this stuff you got won't do you a damn bit of good."
"But what if we don't? It's been weeks. If it's true that they're letting people with kids into camps and towns, then they know not every kid's going to change."
"See, Brett, this is what I'm telling you," said the grandmotherly woman. "Army's got to let you in if you got a kid."
These older ones, they're no good. They'll just cause trouble. But the little girl...
No, Alex said. Ellie was shrinking against her.
Larry's words came floating back.
You might be worth your weight in gold.
You can't have her.
Brett, Tom said. I'm Army, and I'm telling you that their first concern is going to be taking care of themselves, not kids, and not anyone who isn't one of them. Now Brett looked uncertain.
You a soldier? You been to Iraq?
Afghanistan.
What are you doing here? Why aren't you over there?
I was on leave.
Yeah? Iron Face, Harlan, said.
Well, your leave's canceled, soldier. Isn't it when things go to hell you're supposed to be helping?
There's no army up north.
To Brett, he's running away is what he's doing.
I'm trying to keep my people safe, Tom said, but Alex heard a new note in his voice she couldn't decipher, and then she picked up that stinging, sharply chemical scent and thought, Tom's not just scared, he's lying.
Brett, Tom said, going due south or east isn't safe. There's only one base south of us, and it's going to be overrun with refugees. I've seen when crowds get out of control. You don't want to be in that, man.
He's just scared, said Harlan. He's a damn deserter, is what he is.
No, Tom said, but Alex heard. She smelled, yes.
How do you know east isn't safe? Asked Brett.
The radio on the flatbed.
Tom gave a hurried summary, then said,
Going east would be the worst thing to do. Brett, the moon is blue. It's green.
That can only happen when there's crap in the air.
When was the last time you heard anything?
About 2 weeks ago.
Well, hell, said Harlan. A lot can happen in 2 weeks. You said you heard people from Europe? Well, how would anyone way the hell in France know what's going on over here? Remember what those bastards did when it come to Iraq? Saved their own sorry butts.
Harlan's got a point, said the woman.
Brett, Tom took another step toward the older man.
Come on, man, you're not a kill.
The crack of a rifle sent a bolt of fear racing up Alex's throat. Ellie let out a little yip. Tom stopped dead in his tracks. From his place on the flatbed, Harlan said,
Next time I tell you to shut up, Tom, you'll shut up, or I won't be wasting a bullet.
For a moment, Alex thought Tom might defy him, but then Tom shook his head, and her heart fell. If Tom couldn't save them...
Now that's settled, Harlan said. Bring me the damn tent.
When Tom tossed the tent onto the flatbed, Harlan grinned through a jostle of stained teeth that Alex could smell from 20 feet away, years of chewing tobacco and Jim Beam.
Keys.
They're really going to leave us here.
With a kind of detached disbelief, Alex watched as Tom let the truck's keys fall with a muted metallic tinkle to the thin snow.
They're going to strand us in the snow in the middle of nowhere. We've got to do something.
Whose dog is that?
When Alex didn't answer, the old woman nudged her head back with the rifle.
I'm not going to ask again. It yours?
No, she's mine, said Ellie. She was my dad's and then my grandpa's, but she's really mine.
All right, then, the woman said.
She smiled up at Harlan.
Doofers!
Harlan was nodding.
Yeah, taking 'em both's the best thing.
What? Alex cried.
I don't know, Marjorie, Brett said.
Brett, if we take the dog, there won't be as many questions, right? Everyone's got dogs,
Marjorie said.
Dogs and kids is good.
Why? Asked Tom. What are you talking about?
Brett hunched a shoulder. Couple guys we ran into said dogs can tell who's going to change.
Did you rob them, too?
Ellie spat. Brett flushed, and Alex thought maybe Ellie nailed it.
We don't know that's true, he said to Tom. Just what we heard. There's all kind of talk.
A dog and a kid,
Marjorie pressed.
We got them. They'll have to take us in, too.
No. Tom started toward Alex and Ellie, who was cringing against Alex's hip. You can't have either of them.
Hold up, Tom, said Harlan.
I won't help you, Ellie said to Marjorie. I'll tell Mina to kill you.
Fine, said Marjorie, sighting along her rifle. Then I'll just kill the dag now, and we still got...
No,
Tom and Alex cried at the same moment, and then Tom lunged. Marjorie saw him coming, tried bringing the gun around, but Tom ducked under and crowded in, got his hands out, got his hand around the barrel. He gave the rifle a vicious jerk. Gasping, Alex tumbled into Ellie, pushing her into the snow as Marjorie squeezed the trigger. The rifle cracked, the bullet whizzing over their heads, and then Marjorie was backpedaling off balance, and Tom had the rifle, and he was slotting it against his shoulder, already swinging, bringing the rifle up just as Alex saw Harlan on the flatbed pivot. Tom! She screamed.
Chapter 34 3 days later, Alex eased up until her eyes just cleared the ridge of freshly fallen snow mantled over a high stack of firewood. A gust of wind flung snow into her face, and her eyes watered with the sting. Blinking away tears, she peered across an expanse of asphalt parking lot and past a trio of gas pumps. Slotted next to one pump was some flavor of Toyota sedan, abandoned when the power to the gas pump had died and the sedan refused to start. The driver's side door was open, as were, inexplicably, both the driver and passenger side windows in the front. A drift of snow feathered the front seat and dashboard. Another vehicle, a Dodge Caravan, had cut out as the driver was making a turn into the station, both front doors standing open like giant ears. From her vantage point, Alex could see that the panel doors had been slid back on their tracks. There was an empty child's safety seat, and Alex saw the limp, furry red leg of an Elmo doll dragging from the footwell. Her chest hurt at the sight, and she thought again of Ellie.
"What do you see?"
"No bodies."
She looked down at Tom, his back propped against the woodpile. He'd looked worse this morning, feverish and ill, and she didn't think the beads of moisture on his face were snowmelt. Harlan's 22 really had been pretty pissant. The bullet hadn't shattered bone, but it hadn't exited either, and was still lodged deep in Tom's right thigh. She saw with dismay that the strip of flannel shirt she'd used to bind his wound was dark.
"You're bleeding again."
"Yeah." Tom's face was drawn and white, but his eyes were too bright. His tongue skimmed his upper lip.
"Can we get inside?"
"I think so."
Her eyes skipped from the van to the building, a tired-looking combination gas station, convenience store, bait shop deal with a corrugated tin roof piled with snow and polarized windows so dark she couldn't see inside. The front door was shut tight, though, and the windows were intact, which might mean there was someone home. The snow in the parking lot was unbroken, except for animal tracks, probably deer. She took a tentative experimental sniff, got nothing but the scent of motor oil and gasoline. Her eyes flicked to her left wrist. Mickey said it was 4:05.
"Going to be dark soon, and it feels empty," she said.
"I'm going to take a look around back."
"Okay. Might want to have that Glock handy, though. We may not be the only people looking for a place to spend the night."
He was right. She dug under her coat, pulled the gun from its holster, then unfolded to a stand. Even that small movement made her head swirl with vertigo, and she put a hand on the woodpile to steady herself.
"You all right?"
Tom's voice rose with concern.
"Fine,"
she lied. Her hands were jittery, and she felt water weak and nauseated. Her stomach was a raw, empty pit. A person could theoretically survive on nothing but water for a week or so, and while they'd found some food, Alex wasn't sure how much longer she could manage on a theory. They had come across 7 houses since losing Ellie, and each had already been picked almost completely clean, and that included the bodies. At the very last house, they'd been lucky, but only because they'd cut across a field and Tom had spotted a glint of glass far back in the woods. The glass turned out to be the only window left in an otherwise ramshackle hunting cabin. The door was so old that the boards had contracted, leaving wide gaps, and snow had blown in through the ruined windows. There wasn't much in the way of furniture, just a tattered, mouse-eaten couch and 2 broken straight-back chairs, but Alex had dug out a ratty knapsack from one of the bedrooms. They'd hit the mother load in the kitchen.
Some twine, a stub of candle, an old battered aluminum saucepan, a can of Sterno, a jug of bleach, nearly gone, 3 empty water bottles, 4 tins of sardines, 1/3 of a jar of mixed nuts, 1/2 jar of chicken-flavored bouillon cubes, and 4 pouches of beef jerky that had somehow escaped the mice. That had been 2 days ago, and they were down to 1 tin of sardines, 4 bouillon cubes, and 3 pouches of jerky. She'd kept the empty nut jar for the bleach, and used a drop whenever they needed to purify more drinking water. She'd supplemented their starvation rations with a handful of tiny minnows yesterday, using Tom's undershirt as a net to fish them up from a small stream. Otherwise, Tom wasn't eating much, mostly drinking chicken broth and water, and his face, already thin, was gaunt. Their only weapons were Alex's boot knife and Glock, and neither wanted to waste bullets hunting game. Things might have been different if they'd stayed in one place, had a cozy cabin or tent, set up deadfalls, and, oh yes, had bait. But Tom was getting worse, and their progress was very slow, much worse than when she'd been with Ellie, because Tom could only hobble and needed to rest often as they moved southwest, going by memory and dead reckoning. Tom hoped that Brett had listened and gone west. If so, they would have to go past Rule. If Harlan was right, maybe the people there had let them all in, so when Tom and Alex showed, Ellie would be there. Maybe. The only thing Alex was interested in now was finding help for Tom. She just hoped she found it in time. She cautiously wound her way behind the shop. She spotted a corroded truck on blocks and an open dumpster, piled with collapsed cardboard boxes backed against a stand of hardwood. At the base of the dumpster, a trio of rusty paint cans was arranged in a little pyramid alongside a quartet of snow-covered tires piled like discarded tiddlywinks. There was a back door with an unsecured screen held open by snow that had filtered in through the mesh. The screen protested with a loud, grating squall that made Alex wince. When she tried the knob, it turned, and she nudged the door open with the toe of her boot. She tensed, waiting for the boom of a shotgun, but nothing happened. She stepped into a small back hall. A pegboard with hooks was tacked to the wall, from which a jacket still hung. The jacket was light blue, with darker blue stretchy cuffs, and Ned embroidered in black thread over the left breast pocket. A pair of boots rested on the floor. Another door opened to a short, narrow hall. There was a stinking bathroom to the left. The toilet had been used since the power went out and had overflowed in a foul, reeking mess. Alex could see, farther on down the hall, the front door and one wing of a Krispy Kreme case. Then the smell, more powerful than the shit stink from the toilet, hit her, gassy as a sewer and bad enough to make her stomach crawl into her throat. She knew what she'd find. The store was a mess. Bare shelves, empty boxes, burst juice boxes, a squashed donut that had tumbled from an otherwise empty Krispy Kreme display case. Someone had dropped a carton of eggs in front of the dead coolers. Smashed shells and exploded yolk mingled with a lake of milk desiccated to a snot-colored crust. The coolers were empty. To the right of the front door were shelves of fan belts, quarts of oil, and jugs of antifreeze and windshield wiper fluid that looked relatively untouched. The same, however, could not be said of the dead guy. The corpse lay in a pool of dried blood near the front of the store. Most of his face was gone. Without lips or most of his gums, his teeth, stained yellow from cigarettes with some half-rotted, tilted like tent pegs about to blow over in a storm. The back of his shirt and his jeans were chewed to ruins, the muscles and skin of his limbs stripped off the bone neatly as if he were fried chicken. 3 weeks ago, a month, 6 weeks, Alex probably would have thrown up, or run screaming, or both. Now she studied the floor. There had been a few animals, wolves, she thought, or maybe a couple dogs, and several people. The floor was a stencil of rusty shoe prints. The prints were all old, the outlines not even tacky, But then, as her eyes swept across the tracks, she paused. Someone had been barefoot. They'd read Robinson Crusoe in fourth grade. As she remembered it, when Crusoe finds Friday's footprint, he's terrified, believing that the devil might be on the island. But then what surprises Crusoe more is the discovery that after being alone for so long, the idea of other people scares the hell out of him. Looking down at those footprints, she thought of Crusoe. They had not seen any brain-zapped kids, or even signs that they'd been anywhere around the houses or farms. Frankly, she hoped they were all dead. She hoped that with only half a brain, a cannibal kid was too stupid to come in out of the cold. She butted open the front door, and then moved the body, dragging the dead man by his feet, hoping they wouldn't come off. It wasn't as bad as she thought it might be, or maybe she was getting numb to the whole thing. Anyway, it had to be done, because there was no way she was spending the night under the same roof as a corpse. After the relative respite offered by the store, the cold was a shock. The wind had picked up, and icy snow needled her face, but she was relieved to breathe air that didn't smell like decaying Ned. She thought about getting the work shirt from the back room before dark to cover the dead man's face, and then decided that they had more use for it. She felt an urge to apologize to Ned, but didn't. Tom was shuddering with cold by the time she went back for him. She half-supported, half-dragged him inside, eased him to the floor, and then combed the entire store. There was no food, although Alex discovered an unopened water bottle that had rolled under the Krispy Kreme case. Near the front door, she unearthed a package of AA batteries behind an overturned magazine rack. Whoever had ransacked the place hadn't cared if he caught a cold, and had left fistfuls of aspirin and Tylenol and cold remedies in those little foil packets, as well as packages of Kleenex and tins of throat lozenges. Behind the checkout counter, the register's cash drawer was open and empty. Not surprisingly, there were no cigarettes or tins of chewing tobacco, but what did amaze Alex was that the plastic lottery ticket dispensers were also empty, like there would ever be another multi-gazillion-dollar Powerball jackpot in the very near future. There was a back office behind the counter. The door was locked, but the keys still hung on a nail next to the cash register. Inside the office was a plain metal desk and a swivel chair on squeaky casters. In the desk, she found a few pens, two pencils, three paper clips, rubber bands, and, in a bottom drawer, a bottle of Maker's Mark half full. She left the jugs of windshield wiper fluid and antifreeze, but crammed the rest into their knapsack. She lingered over the cans of WD-40 and de-icer, the quarts of oil, thought that of them all, the oil might be good. Soak some rags in the oil and throw them in a plastic bag in case they couldn't find tinder for a fire. Then she tore open a packet of Tylenol, made Tom swallow back the medicine, and then the rest of the water. It was very cold inside the store, but Tom's face glistened with perspiration. His hair was damp, but when she put her hand against his forehead, his skin was very hot. "You've got a fever," she said. "Infection." He was shaking so badly she heard the click of his teeth. I can smell it. So could she, even without her spidey sense. When she took down the bandage, she had to clamp back on a moan. The wound was very bad. The bullet had gone in a little left of center, about 6 inches below Tom's hip. His thigh was swollen and tight, the skin flushed, shiny, and hot to the touch. The edges of the wound were black, and when he moved, a thick worm of blood-streaked green pus bubbled up and ran down the side of his leg. The bandages were oozy and sopping with a mixture of blood and more pus. I don't think I can walk much more, he said.
You walked today.
Too slow.
So what? It's fine. I'm not leaving you behind.
You have to. He let his head fall back. His eyes half shuttered. His lips were split and bleeding.
You would never leave me or Ellie. You'd carry us if you had to. Don't be too sure about that. I could make a stretcher.
His head moved in a weak negative.
Just slow you down. We're not getting anywhere fast this way. You'll be a lot
past her on your own.
She would be, she knew that. Alone, she could cover twice as much ground in half the time, and if she kept heading southwest, she would run into Rule. If Larry was right, if Marjorie and Brett and Harlan were to be believed, whoever was there would want to help Tom. Or maybe something else that Larry had said would be true. They'll shoot you on sight.
We don't have to decide anything right now. Come on, she gave him a little shake. You know medical stuff. Think. Would it help if, I don't know, we got that gunk out of there?
He gave a sluggish nod.
Couldn't hurt. Okay, just give me a few minutes. I want to check out the cars. At the very least, we can use the mats. Better for you than lying on the floor.
The Toyota was closest to the front door, and she searched it first. The car was barren and cold as a freezer. Her breath came in clouds as she hurriedly piled floor mats on the front seat, and then she thought, trunk. Reaching in, she found the right button, popped the release, heard the trunk click open. Jackpot. Inside the trunk were a collapsible shovel and three signal flares. They could use the flares for fires if they had to. Was there a way to reuse the striker? Tom might know. The shovel was for camping, with a triangular steel head and a removable handle that unscrewed to reveal a 6-inch blade saw. She pulled the shovel out to its full length, felt the heft in her hand. From the condition of the head, she didn't think the shovel had ever been used. Backing out with the trunk mat, her eye fell on a corner of white and red protruding from beneath the spare tire. Putting aside the mat, she reached for the bit of color.
Was that?
She felt a little squirt of adrenaline, which she tried to quash, but she knew as soon as her shaking fingers touched the cardboard, and then she was carefully prying the Marlboro box free. Interesting place to keep a stash, but she'd heard of people squirreling away drugs in spare tires, so maybe not so strange if you didn't want your wife or husband to know you couldn't quite kick the habit. The Marlboro box rattled and smelled like cold tar. She didn't care about the cigarettes, but if someone had stashed the pack into the trunk for a rainy day, he'd need a light. She was almost afraid to look, but she did. Inside the box were three cigarettes. She let her breath go. A matchbook. The book had once been white, but was now gray. She could still make out the words beneath a stylized martini glass, Eddie Martini's. And in much smaller letters below that, the restaurant's address and phone number. She held the matchbox between her fingers for several seconds, thinking, "You just watch. There won't be any matches left. There won't." But there were. A half dozen. She let out a whoop. "Tom!" Elated, she ducked out of the trunk, shovel in one hand and the matchbox held high in the other, and then the stink of rotted flesh cut right through the lingering aroma of stale tobacco. Later, she would wonder if things might have turned out differently if she hadn't just inhaled a snootful of Marlboro, but that would be later. Now, she saw not just one kid or two. She saw three. Chapter 35. Two boys and a girl, and they were very close, no more than 20 feet away, and between her and the front door of the station. Judging from the snarl of leaves and debris in the girl's hair, they must have come from the woods behind the gas station. They were filthy and dressed in a motley assortment of clothes that couldn't be their own. The boys were older, maybe in their early 20s. The oldest, lanky with a flop of black hair, wore a woman's pink fur-trimmed parka. The other boy was very fat and wore the remnants of a tattered black poncho so thoroughly used that he looked like a Batman blimp passed through a shredder. The girl was her age, Alex thought. Somewhere along the way, the girl had picked up a man's torn camouflage pants and a too small smeary gray peacoat that rode midway up her arms. Every inch of skin not covered by clothing was a swirl of dirt and blood and what was either engine oil or feces, probably both. The left sleeve was mangled, as if the girl had caught her arm on a branch and simply yanked until the wool ripped. The girl shifted, and Alex saw, peeking beneath her pants' tattered cuffs, a single sneaker on the girl's right foot. The girl's left foot was bare, save for an anklet of bloodied sock. Alex thought back to the blood prints in the store, and with a sudden, sickening twist, realized that the footprint Robinson Crusoe had seen did not belong to Friday. The print had been made by a cannibal. This cannibal, the girl, had a club, a polished length of what looked like very stout, very heavy wood, probably an axe handle. The car. She could dive in, lock the doors, but she was afraid to move. Her knees were wobbly. The Toyota's open back door looked like a million miles away. Anyway, she couldn't just wait them out. The front door to the store was open, and so was the back, and if they got in, they would find Tom. The girl rushed her. She was absolutely silent and insanely fast. Her wiry arms lashed out in a blur, her left hand hooked into a claw, the right swinging the club. Almost too late, Alex ducked. She heard the club whir through the space where her head had been a second before. Then she screamed as a starburst of pain tore into her scalp. The girl had her by the hair, and now Alex was lurching forward, being pulled and dragged off her feet. Off balance, her boots tangling, she stumbled to the icy asphalt, still clutching the shovel in her left hand. The matchbook went flying as she tumbled onto her back. She saw the blur of the club again as the girl cocked her elbow, and Alex jerked left just as the club axed down, crashing against the concrete with a solid thunk so hard that the club splintered. A huge ripping laser burned fire into her scalp, and she felt a stinging jolt. Then she was free, rolling away onto her hands and knees. Left with nothing but a bloody knot of Alex's hair and a toothpick of a club, the girl bawled in frustration. The boys had not moved. Alex didn't have time to wonder if maybe they took turns or simply thought the girl could handle her. Scrambling, Alex was just getting her feet under her when the girl charged again. What happened next was pure instinct. Still crouched on the ground, Alex saw the girl coming, heard the slap of that bare foot, felt her fingers fist around the shovel. Her brain detached and her body simply took over, because then she was unfurling, driving forward, closing the gap. She feinted low, then aimed high. The shovel cut the air, blade on in a vicious chop. The sturdy metal edge sank into the soft, exposed flesh of the girl's neck. There was a great jet of spurting blood burning into the snow like red sprinkles on white icing, and then the girl was falling away, the momentum wrenching the shovel out of Alex's grasp. The girl sprawled, hands wrapped around her throat, gargling as blood pumped between her fingers. The shovel clattered to the ground. Her own momentum spun Alex almost completely around. Disoriented, she looked up, realized she was staring at the stalled caravan half in, half out of the gas station's driveway, and thought, "Oh, God, they're behind!" She caught a papery flutter, the thud of boots against thick snow, and as she turned, a black rippling blur swooped in from her right. The gun, she thought suddenly. In her terror, she'd forgotten all about it. She fumbled the coat open, wrapped her fingers around the grip. The gun, the gun, the gun, the gun. Blimp Boy plowed into her. The Glock went flying. She saw it cartwheeling through the air, heard the thunk as it hit the Toyota, and then she was on the ground again, the boy using his weight to pin her down. The tattered plastic of the boy's poncho dragged at her arms like tentacles, and she thrashed, trying to bat her way free. Gasping, she looked up to see the kid's lips twitching back from teeth that were stained and slimy with gore. "No!" she screamed as the boy's teeth flashed. Tom slammed into the boy. The blow knocked Blimp Boy onto his back, and then he and Tom were rolling, thrashing, grunting. The pudgy boy was snapping at Tom's face, his teeth clashing together. Tom rammed the heel of one hand into the boy's lower jaw. The pudgy boy let out a gurgling howl as his teeth drove into the soft flesh of his tongue. Rearing up, mouth drizzling blood, the boy let loose with a vicious backhand to Tom's jaw, a solid crack loud as a gunshot. Tom's hold slackened for just an instant, and then there was a flash of bloodied teeth as the pudgy boy's jaws battened down on Tom's neck just above his right shoulder. Tom screamed, "No, no, no, no!" Frantic, Alex clawed her way to her knees. Tom and Blimp Boy were still struggling, but even if Tom hadn't been sick and weak, the boy was much heavier, and he was astride Tom. Tom's shirt was saturated with blood. Blimp Boy brought his cocked fist down. There was a sound like eggshells being crushed by a heavy boot as the blow connected with Tom's nose, and then Tom went limp. Screaming, not even aware that she was moving, Alex grabbed up the fallen shovel, wound up, and then swung it with
all her might. The shovel hit with a hollow thunk. She felt the jump and sting of metal against her hands and the force of the impact shiver up her arms. Howling, Blimp Boy went sprawling, but he was still conscious, already rolling onto his hands and knees. That's when she spied the butt of the Glock sticking out from behind the rear tire of the Toyota. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Blimp Boy on all fours shaking his head like a dog, and she whirled, grabbing for the gun. The third boy, whom she had forgotten about, rammed her at a dead run. The blow drove Alex back against the unyielding metal of the Toyota. Alex felt a lightning surge of pain as the car's rear fender jammed her spine. Gagging, Alex sagged, and then she was on her back, the boy slashing with a claw fist. Alex's face fired white hot as the boy's nails scored her flesh from the corner of her left eye to the angle of her jaw. Alex tried twisting away, but the boy brought his bald fist down like a hammer, catching her just above her ear. Her head banged the asphalt, and then a burst of wet copper filled her mouth, and she lost the shovel. Dimly, her head singing with pain, Alex heard the boy screech again, felt his hands close around her throat, and then her air was gone. Her fingers scrambled over his, but he had her tight, and he was shaking her now, pounding her head against the snowy asphalt. The edges of her vision went red and then black, and then the margins began to contract, grow smaller and tighter. Her lungs screamed, and her pulse thundered in her oxygen-starved brain. She fought, but his grip tightened. His thumbs crushed her throat, and the pain was huge. Not just a burn, but a sensation of something breaking in two like a dry twig. Her arms and legs were no longer listening to her, and her hands began to loosen as her hold on consciousness started to slide away. She was going numb, the strength flowing from her like blood, and the pain, too. The bitter cold was no more substantial now than smoke, and her vision was nearly gone, her consciousness fading, and there was nothing she could do. And then her mind gasped a single thought, so crisp and clear it was like a word scissored out of black paper. Knife! Against every instinct, she made herself let go of the boy's hands and reach for her boot. Her fingers brushed fabric and then curled in a sudden convulsive spasm, bunching her pant leg, not because she was thinking anymore, but because she was dying. Her hand closed on hard plastic. With the last of her strength, she jerked the knife from its holder and drove the blade into the boy's left flank. The knife was very sharp, and she felt just an instant's hesitation as the tip met fabric, and then the nothing as it sliced cleanly all the way through the parka and the shirt beneath and buried itself to the hilt in the meat of the boy's back. Arching, the boy shrieked. His hands flew away, and then she was gawping like a fish, pulling air in great wheezy gasps that cut her throat. Tumbling from her body, the boy was shrieking, his fingers closing over the knife handle, tugging, trying to work the blade free. Get up! The fog over her mind bled away. Gagging, she rolled onto her stomach and spotted the Glock 6 inches away. Snatching up the gun, she twisted, crabbing onto her back. She saw the boy on his knees 2 feet away. Her knife, smeary with his blood, was in his hand now, and his raging eyes locked onto hers, and he bellowed. She squeezed the trigger. The shot was very loud. The Glock bucked. The boy's chest bloomed red, and the warm, wet blowback of his blood misted her face. The boy flopped onto his back without a sound. She had time for nothing, not even relief. In the next instant, she heard that familiar papery rustle, turned and saw Blimp Boy surging forward, Tom's blood smeared over his mouth in an obscene leer. And then the fat boy loomed huge and horrible, only 5 feet away. He was there. He was right there. She shoved the gun at his face and fired.
Chapter 36. Tom bled a long time, soaking through a balled-up shirt and his own flannel before the flow finally slackened. Then he told her to use the bourbon. She didn't want to. She knew the alcohol would burn like hell, but she did what he said. As soon as the bourbon hit the raw, macerated tissue, Tom's whole body went rigid, the cords standing out like wires on his neck, his teeth bared in a grimace.
I'm sorry,
she said helplessly. The last thing she wanted was to hurt him even more. Already dark amber, the bourbon turned a muddy brownish purple as it mingled with Tom's blood. She used a scrap of torn shirt to wipe away the sweat from his face.
"It's okay," he said, his voice rusty with pain. There was a crust of blood under his shattered nose, and his eyes were beginning to puff.
"You're doing fine." "I don't know what I'm doing," she said. She felt sick, not with fear now or hunger, but dread. The wound was very deep, enough to expose tendon and muscle and a glimmer of bone. The blood welling up wasn't pumping, and she dared to hope that he wouldn't bleed much more. But she knew she could never move him now. Tom was too weak, too drained. He already had one infection, and she was pretty sure that human bites were as bad as an animal's, maybe worse.
"What about your leg? Should I wash?"
"Cut it."
She froze, unable, unwilling to believe her ears.
"What?"
"Cut it," Tom whispered in that same pained, roughened voice.
"Too much pus. Has to drain."
"I can't," she said, horrified. "Tom, I can't.
Please, Alex. I can't. Can't do it myself."
He paused, his chest heaving, his face oily with sweat. When he spoke again, his words broke with airy gasps.
"The knife. Use a flare. Sterilize, but I'll burn you."
Tom actually laughed, a faint splutter that quickly died.
"Least of my problems. Skin's dead anyway, but the tissue underneath might be okay. But you have to drain it. Alex, do it, please."
His glittery, fever-bright eyes locked on hers, and she read his desperation and fear.
"Before I lose my nerve."
This was like his story about Crow. For Tom to ask her to do something like this, he must know he didn't have many options left or much time. But what if he was wrong? What if she did more harm than good? Outside, she retrieved her boot knife, prizing it from the dead boy's clutching fingers. Plunging the knife into deep snow got rid of much of the gore, and then she used bourbon and water to wash away the rest. At the convenience store's front door, she twisted off the cap of one of the flares and scraped the tip against the striker. The flare caught, the crimson flame spitting fiercely. The knife's handle was a hard black polymer, so she was able to hold it without burning herself as she heated the blade, watching as the color changed from silver to a dull gold to a bright lava red.
"Tom," she said, kneeling over him.
The knife had cooled to a dull orange, but she could feel the heat radiating in waves and knew the steel was still plenty hot.
"You're absolutely sure there isn't another way? Cut it as fast as you can. I'll try not to move. Once you're through skin, you'll have to maybe cut deeper. Heat will help with the bleeding. When the pus starts coming, stop. You'll know when," he panted.
Turning his face away, he pulled in another gasping sob. His eyes screwed shut and his hands balled to fists, but a deep shudder was running through him now, a trembling he couldn't control.
"I'll try to stay on top of it, but no matter what I say, don't stop, Alex. Finish the job." "Oh, please, God," she thought, staring down at Tom's thigh and the blackened, angry eye of his wound. "Please save him. Please help me."
She had seen movies, scenes where men dug around for bullets with bare hands. In movies, people passed out when the pain was too much. But this wasn't a movie or a book. This was, in fact, much, much worse, because Tom did not pass out, and he lasted only 3 seconds before he began to scream.
"That's the best I can do."
She thumbed his tears away. His pain-ravaged face was dead white, his eyes sunken into purple-black hollows, the fleshy lips of his wound gaped, and his thigh was streaked with thin rivulets of bright red blood. But there seemed to be very little pus left. The air reeked with the stink of dead meat, boiled pus, and cooked blood. The mats under his leg had gone soupy with the muck, and she dragged them out, pitching them into the snow before retrieving the floor mats from the abandoned van. She'd used straight bourbon on the raw flesh of his thigh, but now she used a wad of torn shirt stuffed with snow to mop sweat from his forehead.
"You smell like a bar."
"Yeah." His weary gaze fixed on her neck.
"Lot of bruises."
Her throat still felt broken.
"You should see the other guy. Not a joke. That was too close. Can't lose you. I'm not going anywhere,"
she said, knowing deep down that she would be forced to. She sponged away dried blood from his chest. His torso was stippled with other, older wounds, shiny with scar tissue.
"Shrapnel,"
he whispered, feeling the question in her fingers.
"Got myself fragged 6 months ago. You ought to see me light up metal detectors at an airport."
"And this?" She touched what looked like small burn marks just under his left armpit. Then she peered closer and made out letters.
"Eden, Thomas A."
A series of numbers.
"Social Security number,"
Alex thought. The line below read, "O Pause," and beneath that, "Catholic."
"A tattoo?"
she said.
"Yeah, we call them meat tags. Sometimes there's not a lot left after."
He swallowed. "You know."
"Tom."
She reached up to stroke the damp hair from his forehead. His lips were pale, as transparent as glass.
"What are we going to do?"
"Stick to the plan." He tried a smile that quickly faded.
We leave in the morning. All I need is a little rest."
He needed a lot more, and she knew it. They spent the night on a mound of car mats in the convenience store's back room. A few hours before dawn, Tom either passed out or fell asleep. She couldn't tell which. Stretching out along his left side, she hugged his body to hers, so close she heard his heart. She was exhausted but afraid to sleep, worried that he would be dead when she woke up. But eventually her thoughts thinned, and she spiraled down and... The dream again. The one where she saw the chopper, the one carrying her mother and father, take off in that snowstorm. The helicopter rose like a helium-filled balloon, higher and higher, until at the very limit of the sky and the edge of night, it exploded in a fireball. Alex hadn't been there. She'd waited at home, alone, as the storm raged, while her mom did her doctor thing, accompanying a patient on an emergency evac. The only reason her dad was even aboard was that the med tech, freaked by the storm, chickened out, and her dad, trained in ACLS because all cops are first responders, took his place. The chopper had not bloomed into a fireball, either. After delivering the patient, safe and sound, the helicopter took off for home and simply crashed into a hillside. No drama, no 4th of July, although the fire had been so intense that they'd identified the pilot and her parents by their teeth. She was 14. She'd felt nothing when her parents died, no premonition, no seismic shudder, no chasm opening beneath her feet. She had been awake, watching the snow swirl in a golden nimbus around the streetlight at the end of the block, waiting for her father's patrol car to turn the corner. She'd even pictured how that would look, first his lights, and then the cruiser itself pulling together out of the snow like something from a dream. And then a cruiser had appeared, although she'd known immediately that it wasn't her father's. His was a newer model, white and black. The one that pulled into the driveway was older, all black. Still, she didn't think anything of it. Even when she saw the officers unfold and flounder toward the front porch, even when she recognized her father's old partner, she still didn't understand what was happening. Leaving her seat by the window, padding to the front door in her slippers, she didn't get it. Throwing open the deadbolt, opening the door, feeling the gust of cold air push in, she didn't get it. She never got it. It just never dawned on her that anything horrible had happened, until she recognized the minister from their church. Then she got it. A month later, the nightmare started. A year later, when the smoke smell started and Aunt Hannah sent her to that shrink, she'd spun some crap about Alex being Dorothy and her parents flying away to Oz, blah, blah, blah. For the shrink, the dream was all about Alex's fantasy that her parents were still alive somewhere. Alex thought the shrink was full of shit. Her parents were dead. She knew that. The dream was all about her life jumping the rails, blowing up in her face, leaving her with nothing but ashes, which was happening now, with Tom, all over again. When she awoke, Tom's skin was clammy. His fever raged, and his heart was rabbiting in his chest, and she knew she couldn't wait any longer. She had to bring help, or Tom would die. He might die before she returned, but she couldn't just sit and wait, either. Tom wanted her to take the gun. "You might need it." His skin was whiter than salt, so translucent she saw the faint blue worm of tiny veins under his eyes. At least the shakes had vanished, if only temporarily. "I'm not going anywhere." "That's not what I'm worried about. If anyone gets in here, the gun's all you'll have." "If someone breaks in, if it's a couple of those things, a few bullets won't make any difference. Besides, I don't think they're smart enough to do that. They're too one-dimensional." She wasn't so sure the brain-zapped kids were as dumb as all that. They knew enough to stay warm, but she saw what he meant. While the kids could easily have overwhelmed them both if they'd planned their attack and acted together, they hadn't. The girl had a club, and that kid I stabbed figured out the knife pretty quick, but they worked separately. What if that changes? Tom lifted a hand to touch her face. His fingers were ice. "Please take it. If something happens to you, then it won't matter about me." Privately, she thought she stood a much better chance of being shot if she advertised the gun. Given her age, she might be shot on sight anyway. "All right," she said. Then she surprised herself and leaned down and kissed him. She meant to pull back, but his other hand snaked into her hair to cup the back of her head, and the kiss turned into something she didn't want to end, that she worried might never happen again. Her heart filled and her blood warmed, and Tom's scent, spicy and strange, bloomed, nearly overpowering the choke of sickness and decay. Whatever Tom's secrets, this was no lie. When she finally broke away, he said weakly, "At last, something to live for." His face splintered into shimmery prisms, and she knew she would never leave if she started crying.
"Don't you dare die on me."
"I'm not gone yet." But then that twist of emotion, furtive and fleet, chased through his face again. "Alex, what happened before we lost Ellie? I need to tell you."
"No."
She put a hand to his lips. If he told her, would he die? Isn't that what happened when people made confessions in books and movies?
"Don't. It doesn't matter now. Tell me when I see you again."
He captured her hand.
"But it does matter. I need you to know. Please, just listen."
He paused, shutting his eyes against some other hidden pain.
"I'm here," she said. "I'm listening."
"You were right." A single tear trickled from the corner of one eye to disappear into his hair. "About me looking for my fate. I won't... can't tell you everything now. It's not the right time. But I want you to know." He opened his eyes, his feverish gaze holding her fast.
"I found it. I found my fate."
"Me too,"
she said, and meant it. For the first time in what felt like forever, she wanted a future, and she wanted Tom in it. She kissed him again, memorizing the feel and the taste and his scent. Then she shut the door and locked it, and left him there. Chapter 37. She wasn't an idiot. If she kept to main roads, kept moving west and south, she would run into people way before she got to Rule. This might be good and bad. Bad because the survivors were much more likely to shoot first and ask questions later, but maybe good because all the brain-zapped kids she'd seen hung close to the woods. If she paid attention, maybe she'd smell them coming, too. She slogged steadily southwest through a good 2 feet of snow, keeping to the road, her eyes always scanning, searching for movement, for brain-zapped kids, for grandmothers with rifles who thought she might be a meal ticket. There were billboards, too, advertising gas stations and mine tours and gift shops. She spotted a sign for Northern Light, God's light in dark times, and a few others suggested that people stop in at Martha's Diner, breakfast 24/7. The day was fine, sunny and very bright, and not as cold. If the way had been level and the road clear, cross-country skis or snowshoes would have been nice. Sunglasses, too. As welcome as the sun was, her eyes streamed against the wink and dazzle of glare bouncing off snow. The road was clogged with cars and vans and trucks hunkering beneath a mantle of snow. Most were wrecks with smashed windows or doors that yawned like mouths. She kept her eyes peeled for their truck, half hoping she wouldn't find it because she was afraid to know what that really meant. Clouds of birds circled in the sky, while crows lined the trees and perched on icy wires and studied her passage in absolute silence. She felt as if she'd stumbled onto a movie set, the kind where the camera pans back to reveal destruction and devastation all the way to the horizon with no end in sight, and then her, the only thing moving other than the birds. Away from the woods, the air was sullen with smells, engine oil, gasoline, rubber, and death. The stink was so thick and cloying that she gagged, and she wished she had something to tie around her mouth and nose. There were a lot of bodies, all in various stages of decomposition. Many had died in their cars. Others, men and women who'd stumbled from their cars only to collapse on the road that first day, wore shrouds of snow. Even with the cold to slow down the rot, the corpses were hideous, as bloated as those dead cows she, Tom, and Ellie had seen. There were many animals, too. Fat raccoons with paws full of meat, mangy foxes and opossums, their white snouts clogged with gore, braving the daylight for the feast. And of course, there were always the birds, jabbing and pecking and stripping away frozen niblets of flesh right down to the bone. One pair of very large crows squabbled over something in the snow. At her approach, they fluttered off, and she spotted what she thought was a fat drop of blood, only to realize that she was staring down at a woman's disarticulated big toe, the nails still painted a bright, cheery fire engine red. All the dead were adults. Most looked old enough to be parents, but not grandparents. There were empty car seats and discarded lunch pails and book bags, but no kids. No bodies of anyone close to her age or Tom's. Then she saw something that made her blood ice. The farther down the road she went, the more prints she found from the people who'd survived. Boots, sneakers, everyday shoes, even some flip-flops. And footprints. Not socks. Bare feet. That gave her pause. Deer laid down trails, taking the same path to and from streams and meadows. Ducks and geese flew routes they'd taken before. All a hunter had to do was either hunker down and wait, or follow his prey. People took roads. Honestly, they might as well have been wearing cowbells, because it looked to her like those brain-zapped kids weren't simply sticking to the woods now. They might live there, but they'd figured out that if they wanted to eat, they had to go where the food was. Then she noticed something else. Some of the dead people were very old. They had died because they'd been shot in the back, some in the chest, and many in the back of the head. Their clothing had not been tattered or ripped by animals, but it seemed simply taken. These bodies were fresher, too, and lay in bunches in a scatter of discarded empty knapsacks and duffel bags and suitcases. These people had survived only to be robbed and then killed by their own kind, the Harlans, the Bretts, the Marjories. And that's when she finally understood that Larry had been right. Those brain-zapped kids weren't the only, or maybe even the worst, enemy. As she passed by a panel truck, doors open, two ravaged and nearly skeletonized bodies dragging from shoulder harnesses, she heard something that was not the harsh call of a bird. The sound was pathetic, a whimper, almost like the cry of a baby. She looked down and saw an old man and an even older woman sprawled face down near the truck in a scatter of pilfered duffels. They'd been shot in the back of the head, and not too long ago, judging from the lack of snow cover. The woman's coat was bunched up, so Alex could see the spread of her fleshy thighs, ropey with bulging green varicose veins above her support stockings. The woman was flat on her face, her arms flung out in a reverse snow angel. Alex spotted a loop of leather around the woman's right wrist, and more leather snaking beneath the truck. Then she caught the scent, something very familiar.
"Oh, my God," she said out loud. Dropping to her knees, Alex searched the shadows under the truck. Cowering next to the right front tire was a shivering gray puppy.
She had no idea what the puppy was, though it looked like a cross between some kind of hound and a Labrador. When it saw her, it whined, then scooted toward her just an inch on its belly. The stub of its tail moved in a hopeful wag. All of a sudden, rescuing the dog felt important. If she could save the dog, it would be a good sign, like an omen. If she saved the dog, she'd save Tom, too. Later, she'd think about how illogical this was, but that didn't make the feeling any less strong at the time. She tore open a packet of beef jerky and offered a piece to the pup. At the smell, the puppy inched forward again, its nose brushing her fingers, and then it wolfed down the meaty bit, only to spit it out a few seconds later. Whimpering, the pup pushed the jerky with its nose, and she understood that the meat was too tough for the dog to chew. She shoved another piece into her mouth, working it into mush. The rich flavor of spicy smoked beef was so good her stomach cramped, and it took all her self-control not to swallow. When she spat out the meat, she heard herself groan. This time, though, the dog snapped the food up right away, then scooched forward for more. Three more pieces of jerky, and the puppy squirted out from beneath the truck, grunting like a little pig and squiggling and wagging the cropped gray pencil stub of its tail. Unclipping the leash from its collar, she gathered the dog in her arms.
"So what's your name?"
The puppy let go of a little yap. The dog's coat was short and silvery gray, and he, had very blue eyes and big paws, and must weigh a good 10 pounds. She fed the puppy the rest of the jerky, then scrounged in the discarded duffels, and came up with 3 cans of puppy food, a foil packet of puppy kibbles, and a small aluminum water bowl into which she poured a scant 2 inches from her bottle. Afterward, she buttoned the dog up in her jacket, cinching the belt around her waist so the puppy couldn't slip out. When she was done, she looked either a little bit pregnant or in need of a very large bra. The puppy was very warm. When it poked its head out to watch the sights, she started laughing.
"I got you," she said as the puppy waggled all over and kissed her fingers. "I got you. Don't you wor-"
That was when she smelled the wolves.